Welcome to Northern Soundings, Alaska in Conversation. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. This episode, we sing the body electric data.
Unbeknownst to almost all patients, information about you is in essence broadcast around and sold to commercial providers.
Author and journalist Adam Tanner talks about the end of privacy as we know it. I hope you'll join us. Every year, the journalism department at the University of Alaska Fairbanks extends an invitation to a distinguished journalist to come north and serve as the Snedden Chair of Journalism. This year, former Reuters bureau chief and correspondent Adam Tanner occupies the post. Tanner also served as a fellow at Harvard University's Institute of Quantitative Social Science. His 2014 book, What Stays in Vegas? The World of Personal Data, Lifeblood of Big Business, and the End of Privacy as We Know It, found its way onto the Washington Post list of 50 notable works of nonfiction for that year. But it was the recent release of his second book, Our Bodies, Our Data, that prompted me to invite him in for a conversation. As you'll hear, you may think medical information on you is private, but as Tanner explains, anonymity isn't what it used to be.
You and I are sitting in a room with the door closed, and if you were my doctor, it would be the similar situation. But unbeknownst to almost all patients, information about you is in essence broadcast around and sold to commercial providers. It is sold without your name and address. It'll say, man of this age living in this part of town. It will be joined with records about you from the pharmacy, from the blood test lab, from the insurance claims, and from various middlemen. And over time, a dossier will be created about you, anonymized, and there's risks about that that we can talk about, but it's used largely to promote marketing and sales for drug companies.
But it's sort of the accumulation of all these data points and how they're analyzed and sifted that really makes them valuable to companies, I would think.
So, you know, it's a multi-billion dollar trade. The data itself, this patient data that I'm talking about, the company that's biggest in this field called Quintiles IMS is a $20 billion company. So the promotion and sales of drugs is a very big business. Knowing more about the patients and about the doctors is very valuable. There are also named dossiers about doctors. So it says your age, your zip code, various information about you without revealing your name. It does have the name of your doctor. And these companies gather doctor profiles. And they know that your doctor usually prescribes drug A, but someone working for drug company B will come see the doctor and say, doctor, let me take you out to lunch. Here's some free samples. Let me give you this and that and explain why this drug B is what you should be prescribing to your patients.
The problem, as you kind of outline here, is that through this sophisticated analysis, our anonymity isn't so anonymous.
That's right. So the more information you have about someone, the more clues you have over time, sort of like a word game or where you have just a few letters revealed, it might be hard to see what the full sentence says. But when more letters are revealed, the clues were enough to identify you. So, for example, if there is a medical dossier about me in the last three cities where I have lived, just knowing my date of birth, gender, and postal zip code might be enough to identify me because I have lived in the following sequence of cities. I'm now living in Fairbanks, Alaska. Before that, I lived in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and before that, in Belgrade, Serbia. So I might be the only one who matches that three sets of cities and had medical stuff in those three different cities. If someone frequently goes to another city in the lower 48 or visits a relative frequently, but from time to time has medical stuff there, again, there's more clues about you that could be used to identify you. I think ultimately what's most troubling about the system is that everything is hinged on confidence in the system, in this anonymity, that you go to the doctor, you tell them the problem, the doctor will not tell anybody. And then the pharmacist gives you some drugs to treat you. He won't tell anybody. And the blood test lab is finding out from inside of you stuff that's very intimate. All of this, you believe it's anonymous, and you might be more distrustful of the system if you knew that there was a commercial trade. So I think ultimately, the risk is to the confidence in the system, but there's also other risks.
Mm.
At the end of your first book, you give some pointers on how to protect yourself. Is there a way we can protect ourselves with this medical data if it's not too strong a word, breach?
It's more complicated when it comes to medical data. When it has to do with non-medical data, you can change how you look at things on the internet, how you purchase things, various privacy protection tools you can use. The problem with medical data is you often do not have a choice of who your doctors or insurance plans are. Some insurance companies do sell this anonymized data about you, others don't. Some electronic medical record systems that doctors use sell the data and others don't. It would take quite a bit of work to figure out which systems are selling the data, to choose your doctors and insurers based on that. Often we don't have a choice because our employer provides the insurance. We're in a health plan that has a certain set of doctors. What you really need to do is change the rules to better protect our information.
I was shocked some time ago to learn that if a researcher finds a unique DNA signature that later proves to be beneficial down the line, there's nothing the person that DNA sequence was taken from has any recourse to either the profits that company ultimately may reap or denying them access to that sequence of DNA. And I'm thinking with medical data, that powerlessness must be even greater.
So DNA is a very interesting subject because it has great potential for science to unlock various mysteries of disease and health. But at the same time, DNA is uniquely identifying. And so if DNA information is included in these sold records about you, eventually you can be identified. Now, there are good government and other efforts to use DNA information to help science. The U.S. government under President Obama initiated a program to gather 1 million DNA samples from volunteers to help advance science. In this case, you had the choice. Oh, I want to volunteer and help researchers and scientists find out more about the mysteries of the human body and disease. But the difference there is you had the choice. If you wanted to, you could knowingly participate. The problem in all this other data trade that I'm talking about is you go to the doctor's office, you don't have a say, and in fact, you're not even informed that there is a trade in your data.
And the other side of the coin, as it were, is these algorithms and these powerful programs that sift through billions of points of data. And there is a part of me, Adam, that is paranoid enough to think at some point the algorithm, when AI comes on, is just going to be a runaway train. And again, we're relatively powerless on that.
So it's worth explaining that the rules about medical data have to do with the doctor's office, your insurance, your specific medical providers. But we give away insightful health information at every turn of our daily lives in the internet era. All of that information can be freely traded with your name on it. And so what happens in this case is if you buy something on the internet, if you go to a store and you're part of their loyalty program, if you use a fitness tracker of some kind, all of that information can be and is often sold with identifying information. So they may know that Robert is a guy who subscribes to every cable channel, and he wears a big pant size, and he eats a lot of fatty foods when he goes shopping. He's probably not the kind of guy we want to give life insurance to, or he's not the kind of guy that we want to give a discount to. The darker side of that is maybe he's not the kind of guy that we want to promote or hire in our firm or to give a certain opportunity. So the darker side of this trade in our medical data is that it can lead to some kind of discrimination. Now, you may think, actually, you're in quite good form, and what I described about you is not true, but you may have friends or classmates or associates who have suffered from mental health or various diseases or health issues in the past, and this information in wide commercial circulation could lead to embarrassment at the least, or loss of opportunity, or some kind of serious discrimination.
Are there groups out there that are kind of trying to rein some of this in or bring a certain amount of order, consumer groups or medical information groups?
So there are a few groups. There's one called Patient Privacy Rights, which is headed by a psychiatrist based in Austin, Texas. There's a few organizations in Washington and elsewhere that look at privacy more broadly and highlight these issues. The trouble has been, as I mentioned to you, that the trade is so opaque. These companies that are selling and buying our data are so closed about what they do that it is very difficult to find out. Now, I had the good fortune to have worked 5 years covering the Kremlin in Russia and working for many years beyond that as an investigative reporter. So I was able to apply some of those techniques that I had learned to try to uncover what's going on. But it is a bit troublesome that industry has decided that this is what's going to happen. This is allowed. It's legal by the definitions of HIPAA because your data, if anonymized, is allowed to be freely traded. But I think we need to know what's going on and then decide, well, is this what is best for society? Is what we as citizens want or not?
You're listening to Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. My guest is Adam Tanner, the Snedden Chair of Journalism at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Tanner traveled extensively with Reuters, reporting from Russia and serving as bureau chief in Belgrade, Serbia. As he explains, it was curiosity about world and social events that drew him into journalism.
So I grew up in New York City, and I was just interested in what was going on in the wider world. I worked in radio in college, WKCR-FM in New York City. And during one school summer, I was in Poland when the Pope, John Paul II, was there. And it was just so exciting to see a tumultuous crowd during an era in which communist government was under assault from the Solidarity trade union movement. That I thought to be a foreign correspondent would be something that would be very appealing to me. And so I did eventually join Reuters, and I served in Moscow, in Berlin, in Belgrade, and traveled to many other countries as well.
Turning to your time in Moscow, it seems Russia has grown increasingly large in our political landscape because of its supposed or reported role in hacking into DNC databases and whatnot. Did that surprise you when those revelations occurred?
I mean, for already quite a number of years, Eastern Europe, Russia has been at the forefront of hacking, and hacking has been on the rise. Incidentally, medical hacking is seriously on the upswing, one of the most vulnerable areas of information, and there is a underground trade in our medical data that's quite alarming, and people use it for to create fake identities, to get credit cards, to get medical services that they need, to try to get tax return refunds. So there's a lot of things that can happen through that hacking. And when you're based in the Ukraine or Russia or in the Balkans, you are further away from the reach of the law, and maybe it's more profitable to do it there. So all of these places have very smart people with a strong tradition in sciences. So it's not surprising that it's happening. When I was in Russia in the 1990s, just after the fall of communism, this issue of kompromat, or compromising material, was something often in circulation, that a certain politician would be threatened with kompromat, and then they would disappear or they would resign. So sometimes there were. I remember the prime minister saying that he had suitcases full of kompromat about various things, right? So these are tricks that go back a long time. It's a bit alarming and surprising that the tricks over there used for domestic politics have now become part of our politics as well.
You passed through and were bureau chief in so many important regions. Was there a particular assignment that you found especially rewarding?
I mean, in all of the places I've been posted in Washington, in Berlin, in Moscow, in Belgrade, San Francisco for 5 years, all of them were compelling in their own ways. Interestingly, in some way, in the big historical perspective, many of the countries that I lived in produced the worst dictators in history. And so I have been a student of that. So in Germany, Hitler, Stalin in Russia, and Lenin, Balkans, Milosevic of the 1990s. I worked for a couple of summers in Cambodia, which produced the Khmer Rouge and Pol Pot. And so I've done a lot of thinking recently, actually, about what produces the circumstances for dramatic change in society and what can be twists that the society didn't expect when they went down a certain path. But I think the 1990s in Russia was just fascinating to live there because this was the first years after communism, but it was a tough time to live there, including for the foreign correspondents.
Mm, I can imagine. Does your analysis or reflections on countries that have brought dictators to power, give you any insight about how America's progressing?
I think it is interesting to look at other countries and other histories to gain some insights on what's going on here. Now, the results of the election here in November are similar to some of the national sentiments in other countries. And so I would look at things such as the vote in Britain to leave the European Union, Brexit, or a right-wing swing in Poland or in the Philippines, where you have a more authoritarian leader than Turkey. A lot of places feel that they've lost control over their fate with globalization, with economic forces no longer being so purely domestic as they once were, with the world affecting things. And so that does impact how people feel about it. Thinking about various parallels, one interesting one is Milosevic, who was the man who grew to be the head of Serbia during the 1990s. Now, Milosevic was head of the bank in Serbia, and he was a successful businessman. He rose up with people thinking that he could help bring the Yugoslav economy into better situation. And initially, he wasn't doing very well politically as a junior communist. And eventually, he discovered that nationalism, appealing to Serb pride, was something that was going to be successful. And at one point, he famously says to Serbian ethnic minority in part of the country called Kosovo, he said, you will not be beaten again. No Albanian will beat you. And all of a sudden, his popularity swells. But the problem of riding that force of nationalism by appealing to the national pride is once you let that tiger out of the cage, it is very hard to control. And so what followed in the Balkans was this terrible war that went on for years from 1992 to 1995. In Bosnia alone, 100,000 people die and so on. And so it's one thing to be incredibly successful in gathering votes and gathering publicity. And certainly Trump has been a genius of gathering publicity and attention for himself. The problem is sometimes you unleash forces that are harder to control in unleashing that process. And so that's what's interesting in the twist of things as we go forward.
This is Northern Soundings, Alaska in Conversation. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. I'm talking today with Adam Tanner, former Reuters reporter and bureau chief. He's traveled extensively, and I talked to him about the U.S.'s relative disinterest about what's happening abroad.
So we're in a huge country where you can travel for a long time without hitting foreign lands. So you don't need to be well-versed to live a very satisfied full life in the United States to be well-versed in other countries. If you live in Belgium or, in an hour, you're in another country, right? If you're in Germany frequently, you're going to be in France or Poland or somewhere else. So these countries that are relatively much smaller than us, people do speak more foreign languages, do have more exposure to that, and history is part of that. Living in Alaska, one thing that has struck me is that Americans know rather little about Canada, for example. And I think we should know more about Canada. It's an interesting country with many of the same social and economic problems and achievements as we have, but we know little about it, right? But I understand why that's the case. In my teaching here at UAF, I try to encourage people to study some of these international examples. I think they're interesting just in and of themselves, but they do give insight as to what could happen in our country. And that's why I think it's worth reading up on these things.
We often hear it decried that the daily newspaper is under siege and there are real issues involved. Any insight on that? Are the days of the newspaper numbered?
Well, the days of the traditional newspaper are numbered, in which there might be several dailies, maybe one in the morning, one in the afternoon, multiple competition. And that is troubling. But part of it was that in the olden days, they had a monopoly on certain kinds of things. If you wanted to run a classified ad, you'd likely run it in the newspaper. They had lots of advertising sources of revenue that made it a very profitable business. And the internet, things like Craigslist, has made it very difficult to enjoy that same level of profit. Many cities no longer have more than one paper, and some cities are at risk of losing their only source of information. And the trouble with that is who's going to cover the city council, who's going to keep accountable local government, state government, and so on. In a big state like Alaska, it's especially difficult because the distances are so vast. the difficulty of figuring out what's going on in the state. Now, of course, the internet makes it possible for any citizen to post that, but you want to have some gatekeeper who says, look, here's the most important things that are happening today. And some newspapers are still doing an outstanding job, such as the New York Times. But I, like many other people, are troubled by the local papers, which are not quite as robust as they have been in the past.
The press has been vilified. As a journalist, as a longtime practitioner of the craft, does that concern you?
Well, yes. But I would mention that there's many different layers of what is journalism. There is book journalism. So we started talking about my book that took years to produce. And the previous book to that took years to produce. So very slow, methodical, working over time, building up sources, building that. You go some steps down from that, you'll have magazine journalists, newspaper journalists, people who are working on a daily or a weekly basis. I think a lot of the stirring of troubles or popular sentiment is often have to do with electronic media and specifically television. So television, for example, was the media that gave the most exposure to Donald Trump early on. And so when he was on a candidate amongst 16 or 17 people, they would go to his news conferences live and give him a lot of coverage that the other candidates weren't getting. So it's interesting for Trump. On one hand, his rise has been greatly assisted by that all that media coverage that he got in the campaign. At the same time, beating up on the media has been something that he's done very successfully to bolster his support. But I've also seen this beating up on the media in a number of foreign countries where I have been. And so in the Balkans during the war, in Russia under the Soviet Union before that, in Germany in the more distant past, often the media was blamed for other social ills. So it's often convenient to blame other people for your own problems. And so in this case, the media is sometimes blamed. Of course, there are inadequacies in the media. There is poor reporting, but there's a lot of great reporting that is very informative and useful. So I don't think it deserves to be beat up all the time. But for example, the campaign, of the election campaign was media coverage may have been lacking in some regard. So certainly valid to talk about it and criticize from time to time, but beat up on it as a terrible force for evil is not right.
Well, and I guess in the United States, at least so far, beaten up verbally is about the worst of it. But as you point out, in other countries, journalists lose their lives for having written a story or taking a point.
That's right. When I lived in Russia, there was the editor of the Forbes edition in Russia, and we were in the same building, which is a big hotel there. One day he stepped out to go home, I believe, and he was on the way to the subway. He was killed, right? So that happens in some places, and certainly in more authoritarian places. In Turkey recently, there's been crackdowns on journalists. And I've even been detained briefly in various countries for taking photographs, for example. So I've seen this. Of course, we don't have that level of problem, but if you stir up a lot of public resentment against the media, it may be harder to do the job to then inform people. And you want to inform them first and foremost what government is up to, what our public institutions are up to, because we, the people, pay for this stuff and we deserve to know what's at work.
You taught and researched at Harvard University, arguably the premier university in the United States. What shifted your attention? Did you recognize this question of data would need time to develop? What happened there for you?
So working as a journalist, I was in San Francisco from 2003 to 2008. And this was a time in which databases about people was becoming increasingly commonplace. And so I was able to look up people. One of the stories at that time was the sports steroid scandal around Barry Bonds and others. And often I thought, well, it'd be interesting to hear what old timers, Hall of Famers have to say about this. These are the guys whose names were in the record books until these younger steroid infused guys were breaking the records. What do the old timers have to say? And I was often able to find them thanks to the accumulation of public data about them. So for my purposes, it was quite useful. And of course, I would call them up and I would say, Yogi Berra, here's what I'm doing. May I talk to you? And if they didn't want to talk, that would be the end of that. But if they did, I'd have some material. So I was interested from that and also some prior experiences in Eastern Europe where government data gathering was so common in the Soviet era, to see what was going on in the commercial sector with the gathering of our data. And in my work, I sort of divide the world of personal data into two spheres. One is government-collected data. So that's Snowden and the revelations about what the U.S. government has done. And then there's the private sphere, what businesses collect about us. Now, the U.S. government has the ability to gather extensive amount of information about all citizens if they wanted to, but they don't have active dossiers on hundreds of millions of people. They don't need to have it. It's not of interest, whereas commercial companies do. So there are data brokers with commercial information about you, specifically your name, address, whether you like to hunt or fish, where you live, what kind of money you make, and so on. And then there are these data miners, these related companies that gather this information about your medical data. I just thought it was a fascinating, unexplored sphere of the economy that's worth billions and billions of dollars. It's about us all. It impacts us all and increasingly will impact us in the future, but one that many people prefer not to talk about, especially within these businesses, because it's so lucrative and they're worried about stirring up public fears or concerned about it.
Well, as UAF's Sneddon Chair, you're teaching classes and seminars. Do you like teaching? And how does that seems like pretty valuable work to raise a new generation of journalists.
So in the fall, I taught a class on called Perspectives in Journalism, where we talked a lot about the political campaign. And with events twisting so frequently, it was quite interesting to keep abreast of the media coverage and what was going on. And I remember maybe a highlight of the term was the day after the election, I just invited everyone from campus, whoever wanted to come and like talk. And the room was full. The dean was there, various other professors, students, everyone pro and against Trump were quite surprised or in shock about the events. And so to be able to talk about contemporary events in a learning environment, I found very stimulating. This semester, I'm teaching a course called The Globalized North, which is about the links between Alaska and the rest of the world. So in the rest of the country, many people think, oh, Alaska, it's in the middle of nowhere. There's nothing there. People live in cabins and they have no conception of how interlinked we are, that we eat grapes on our table from Peru and we have all this, you know, our economy is hinged on the price of oil worldwide and we have all these international people and Fairbanks has a huge amount of Thai restaurants and all these things, right? So we are so linked to the world. So in this class, we will be listening to some top CEOs from the field, top executives, public figures and others that will come and talk to us about these links with the rest of the world. I think it's quite rewarding and quite interesting to explore the world in that way.
Well, Adam Tanner, the Sneddon Chair of Journalism for University of Alaska Fairbanks, thanks for coming down and talking with me.
Thanks. One last thing to mention. If people are interested for more information, I have a website, which is adamtanner.news.
Well, thank you.
That's it for this episode of Northern Soundings. Today's guest has been Adam Tanner, Sneddon Chair of Journalism at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Links to Tanner's books and his website are at northernsoundings.com. For KUAC listeners, Adam is giving a lecture and performance on the sitar this Thursday at Davis Concert Hall at 1 p.m. He'll look at its influence on Western pop culture. Until next time, I'm your host, Robert Hannon. Thanks for listening.